Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show I talk to the great Jesse Eisenberg about his new Oscar-tipped movie, A Real Pain, as well as hearing about the movie that changed his life. I talk to the Irish breakout star of Netflix's Black Doves, Ella Lily Hyland. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all and a happy new year. It is nice to be back with you and I hope you had a pleasant Christmas and a joyful new year. Or maybe you didn't. Maybe you were sick, like half of the country. My heart goes out to you because there was an awful lot of people and I know still continuously sick with this awful flu and colds that are going around. But I spoke to an awful lot of people who were sick over Christmas. It's like the air comes out of the balloon and we're just more susceptible to getting sick. I'm no Luke O'Neill, so, you know, that may not be the scientific fact about how illness works at Christmas time. That's my unfounded assumption, though. But I do hope you're well, and I do hope between sneezing and runny noses and being bedridden, you had a nice Christmas and a nice new year. I certainly had one too. Just seemed to eat. I think I might have said this to you last year. I can go from one end of the year to the other without eating cheese. You know, cheese is fine, but like this idea of having a cheese board or sitting down having cheese after a meal, it would never occur to me during the year. But then something happens around Christmas Eve and I'll just have some cheese every day, you know, whether I'm hungry or not, which I think is very unhealthy eating when you're actually full. But anyway, so that was what the cross I was bearing. So I also watched an awful lot of TV, or certainly there was a lot of TV on and I saw loads of it. I guess the show a lot of people are talking about since I last spoke to you is Squid Game 2. It's back. It landed on Stevens' day. It's already doing huge numbers. You know, Squid Game, in case you don't know, it was this massive hit from over 3 years ago where a young Korean man, it's all set in South Korea, goes off to play in this very strange game and they play children's games and people who lose get shot. It's become this phenomenon because it was brilliant. Season one of Squid Game was gripping television, and in the point that you sit down and within 5 minutes you're hooked, and it's so inventive and clever and pressure and anxiety inducing. There was nothing quite like it. So Squid Game 2 has returned, and by golly, I think it's very good. It's only 7 episodes. What I like about this one is the main character is back playing the Squid Game again, but he doesn't begin with that. He basically wants revenge from the first time around. If you haven't seen the first season, you probably don't know what I'm talking about. But let's just say he eventually makes it back to Squid Game. The games are different. But I think this is as gripping as the first one. I really do. There's nothing quite like it on TV. It's incredibly well-made television. So it's a big thumbs up for Squid Game 2 for me. And as I said, particularly like the first 2 episodes where we're not in Squid Game, we're in South Korea and we're possibly seeking revenge. I just thought it was great. I've watched the whole thing and I really like it. It is geared up for season 3. Maybe that's a spoiler, but hey, you know, it's just a click away. But Squid Game 2 on Netflix, great so far. And what I love on one level as well is that, you know, millions of people in this part of the world are watching a TV show in a foreign language and no one is complaining about it being subtitled, because good drama is good drama and subtitles in different languages become irrelevant or highly relevant, but they become incidental to your enjoyment of them. So Squid Game 2, a big thumbs up from me. Thumbs ups. Talking of giving big thumbs ups to things, I can't, what's the plural of thumbs up? I can't say it, whatever it is. However, what I am trying to talk about is this.
Tell me tomorrow, I'll wait by the window for you. I'll wait by your big house for you. I'll wait by the squeeze box for you.
The glory glorious sound there of Stephen Fretwell, which is the signature tune synonymous with the great Gavin and Stacey. That song's called Run. And Gavin and Stacey ended. Regular listeners know I'm a big fan of that TV show. This was the Christmas special 4 years after the last Christmas special and the finale of the much loved and rightly adored TV series from the brain of James Corden and Ruth Jones. And look, we don't have to rehash the whole series or anything, but if you're a fan of Gavin and Stacey, I think you will have been delighted by the finale, because I thought it was perfect. I thought it didn't miss a beat, or it hit all the beats, if that's saying exactly the same thing twice. It was just perfect, note perfect. Where it ended up, we always knew where it was going to end up, but it got there beautifully. I just thought it was a perfect, perfect finale. I really did. And I think Gavin and Stacey has now entered the pantheon of great British television, or great television, because it had three series, it had three Christmas specials, and they were note perfect. All of them were funny, sweet, charming, occasionally sad, often joyous, absolutely wonderful TV. I was so impressed with the finale. Now, unless you have access to the BBC player, as of now, you can't watch it back, but I'm sure it's going to make its way to something soon, because people will be dying to see it and millions of people tuned into it. So I was utterly delighted with it, I have to say. Now, I'm afraid I can't say the same for Mrs. Brown's Boys. I'm not one of those people who hate on Mrs. Brown's Boys. There is a time and a place and an audience for Mrs. Brown's Boys. Some of it I find funny over the years. One of the funniest jokes I've ever heard was from the stage show, which I can't repeat, but involves opera and things men and women might do together. One of the funniest jokes I've ever heard. So I'm all about it. I'm a big fan of Brendan O'Carroll. I met him years ago when he talked to me about his favourite poems. We won't get into that, but he did it brilliantly. He's a highly intelligent man, a highly funny man, and hats off to him for the success he's had, because it's richly deserved. That said, I did think, particularly the episode on Christmas Day, where Mrs. Brown is in a bad mood and is a bit cranky about Christmas, was pretty terrible, because there was a wafer thin plot that was something about Grandad was having an affair maybe, and Mrs. Brown herself or himself was cranky, and then there was a thing about feeding homeless people, but none of it really came together at all. I mean, the plot was, you know, a microdot of a thing. So I was very unimpressed, and it gives me no joy, as regular listeners know. I don't like taking hits at something, but gotta call it out. I just thought he needs to spend longer on next year's plot. The one on New Year's Day was a bit better, and there were some laughs in it. I'm not singing and dancing about it by any stretch, but the one on Christmas Day was not good. Do let me know what you were watching over Christmas. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. Of course, you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. There is one more TV show I do want to mention, though, because it took me a while to get to it, but I did, and it's this.
Jack, land this ship immediately.
We have to get to the other side of this moon to make the jump.
Other side? We'll never make it that far.
Once we see daylight, we're gone.
Neil, I need you to take the controls and evade their fire.
Neil? I can't fly a ship.
Like this. Just wiggle the controls and evade.
Yes, the sound of Jude Law there and his young accomplices in The Skeleton Crew. This landed in Disney in the middle of December. Yes, we often bemoan the Star Wars franchise being plundered and every part of the universe with these endless series. I'm a big Star Wars fan, as you know, but Skeleton Crew is something a bit different and very fun, I have to say. Jude Law, you heard there, is, well, we're not sure who he is, and let's not say much more than that, but he rubs up against four kids who have lost, or who have, through a spaceship malfunction of sorts, find themselves many thousands, if not millions of miles away from home. They're desperate to get back there. They're in another part of the galaxy where they don't belong. And a swashbuckling adventure with pirates and all sorts of things ensues. Four young teenagers, one of them looks like an elephant. That's, you know, actually he's a creature of sorts. And what I love about this is that it's reminiscent of something like The Goonies or Stand By Me. It has a kind of young swashbuckling feel to it where kids go on an adventure, something the Star Wars franchise hasn't done before. They tried a lot of other things, and to the point that my 12-year-old, who's been watching it all and enjoying it immensely, and he's a big Star Wars fan, he had no choice, but he is a big Star Wars fan. He was saying in the first episode, this doesn't look like Star Wars. Like, the first episode is kind of like something out of Stranger Things or something in the setting. It's kind of suburban Star Wars. But it gets going. They leave their suburban planet and they go around the various parts of the galaxy trying to get home on a spaceship. And Jude Law, who we're not sure who he is, shows up and befriends, helps, to a certain extent, this raggle-taggle band of young teenagers traveling the galaxy. It's very entertaining so far and has a lot of nice Star Wars-isms in it as it goes along. So I'm enjoying The Skeleton Crew very much, now streaming on Disney Plus, dropping weekly. So there's a fan base out there regularly waiting every Wednesday for it to land. So that is The Skeleton Crew on Disney Plus. Yes, I've been rabbiting on for a while there about all the TV I watched, but I had to get you up to speed, you know. I did also see Better Man, the Robbie Williams biopic that Chris Wasser reviewed in our show Before Christmas, where Robbie Williams' character is played by a CGI monkey, telling the early years of Robbie Williams and into his Take That fame and falling apart. Chris Wasser was right. It is brilliant. It's just a vivacious whack in the face of a musical biopic. And the idea of, you know, it's CGI chimpanzee playing Robbie Williams sounds silly and off its head. It works brilliantly. And what they've done with the rock biopic is absolutely brilliant. So do check out Better Man. It's wonderful. A highly entertaining, intriguing watch. Now, talking of an intriguing watch, there is a new movie out called A Real Pain, starring the great and written by and directed by Jesse Eisenberg, and I'll be talking to him after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show, and let me wish you a happy year again, happy new year. Not a happy year, well, a happy year too, but a happy new year if you've just tuned in. Now, take a listen to this.
You know, Grandma never pitied herself. In fact, she always told me she was grateful for her struggle.
Well, that's just it. What she endured, that gave her hope, right?
Yes. In fact, she used to tell me that, like, you know, first-generation immigrants work some, like, menial job. You know, they drive cabs, they deliver food. Second generation, they go to good schools, and they become, like, you know, a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. And the third generation lives in their mother's basement and smokes pot all day. I mean...
She said that?
I think she was, like, just speaking generally about, like, the immigrant experience.
I lived in my mom's basement.
She was just talking about immigrants.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah. I got to pee.
There we go.
I'm gonna go to the bathroom. I'll get that. Don't worry. Pee-pee time.
Yes, now that is a clip from a movie that is out this Wednesday called A Real Pain. It follows the mismatched cousins, David, played by the great Jesse Eisenberg, and Benji, played by Kieran Culkin, as they reunite for a tour through Poland to honour their beloved grandmother. The adventure takes a turn, though, when the odd couple's old tensions resurface among the backdrop of their own family history. And there is a Holocaust dimension to the story, and they go on this tour with other mostly Americans that they're going to tour World War II scarred Poland, let's say. And there's a brilliantly observed relationship between these cousins, who are also best friends as well. And there's a whole piece about history in it as well. This is a really great watch, a delightful kind of study of male friendship, and also a look at history and how that history might affect lives, be it two or three generations later. A lot of buzz about this movie, rightly so. It's a slow, charming, heartfelt, beautiful movie, A Real Pain. It was written and directed and stars Jesse Eisenberg, who plays one of the two cousins opposite Kieran Culkin. Jesse Eisenberg, does he need any introduction? He is the man from Social Network and Squid and the Whale. He was in an Irish movie called Vivarium. He's been in all sorts of things. He's a great actor. He's also a cool dude. And I spoke to him earlier in the week about A Real Pain. I'm sorry if you've been asked this a few times, Jesse, but I really like the film, and I really like, you know, the study of friendship. I know they're cousins, but it kind of reminded me of friends of mine and people in my life. And I wonder, as a genesis of the storytelling, if it's not too personal a question, was there a particular relationship in your life that you were trying to mime when you were writing this?
You know, I've found myself in certain relationships where I really, really envy the person, just like my character envies Kieran's character in this movie. And I found that, like, I become so enamored by people who are charming, who are comfortable in their own skin, who can command attention in a room and not feel embarrassed. And yet when I think about these people, and I think about sometimes like what their lives are like, you know, after the sun goes down and after the party ends. And I sometimes wonder if there's maybe a loneliness there that I wouldn't want. I've created kind of like, just in my own personal life, just a life of kind of stability. I'm married, I have a kid, and I just like really prize my routine, because a life like Benji's in this movie scares me so much, you know, to feel like, you know, it's too scary to live in the moment, because what if the moment doesn't turn out well? And so yeah, I kind of was just thinking about relationships I've had in the past and people I've envied, and then it just turned into this very fictionalized kind of relationship.
Yeah, and you know, there's that, not to get too pretentious on you, Proust quote about the vulgar heat of jealousy when it comes to our friends, you know, the people we admire, but maybe we feel a bit, you know, how do they have it all when the sun goes down, or what happens to them? But anyway, as I said, I'm getting pretentious. Yeah. Tell me this, again, a bit of a personal question, but I gather, I suppose, the whole genesis in another department was a very close relationship with your Polish aunt, who had been displaced prior to the war. I mean, you know, as a filmmaker, as a writer, do you have any reservations about opening that seam in your life, that people like me end up asking you questions about your aunt, who's, you know, none of our concern really, but we can't help when we know that's in your life?
Oh, God, no, of course not. No, not at all. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, I can't think of anything wrong with talking about a character through fiction, or talking about the person who inspired it, in this case, my great aunt. No, she was an amazing person. And, you know, I was always trying to impress her by, like, I would say, I'm going to mention you on the Tonight Show. And, or like, I talked about you on the Tonight Show, and she just wouldn't be impressed. I don't, you know, she knew what it was vaguely, but she was just totally unimpressed with that. But no. She was an amazing person who lived a very unusual life, and came from very, you know, and had a very, you know, had a very unusual upbringing in Poland. And her name is the name. Her name was, you know, her name's Doris, but we call her Grandma Dory in the movie. And I mean, I told the cast about her, and I wanted Kieran to understand what she was like. So when he's talking about her, he has some, you know, evocative image in his head. And no, not at all. No, I was so thrilled to and happy to talk about her. Yeah.
And I gather from something I read that, you know, you went to one of the homes she lived in when she was young, and that you were kind of, you had a weird reaction to it, in a way that you were kind of almost expecting an epiphany of some sorts. And often in life, these things don't pan out that way. Could you tell me just a little bit about that, or what you found unusual about that experience?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I traveled to Poland in 2008 with the kind of direct purpose of trying to find this house that my family lived in. This was before Google Maps, and it was difficult to get down there. And, you know, driving through the foggy nights of Poland, difficult to see street signs or road signs rather. And so, when I finally got to this house, it felt like, you know, the climax of a big trip, but it also felt like the climax of a life, you know, of a grandson. You know, and to look at this place that had so much significance in my family's history and then was torn apart, you know, so brazenly. And so, yeah, I was expecting to feel something, but it just was kind of impossible. I was trying to, you know, foment some kind of, you know, emotional catharsis, and just wasn't feeling it. And that's kind of what happens to the characters in this movie.
Yeah.
I think even in the script, it says they stand in front of the house trying to feel something. And yeah, that's the idea for me, is that they're just like, you know, like when we try to connect to history, sometimes we do it in these kind of awkward, literal ways that don't produce the effect we're expecting. And I was trying to kind of express that in the movie, just the awkwardness of trying to connect to history and having a feeling that is unexpected, or expecting a feeling that doesn't come.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to give any kind of spoiler, right? But mm-hmm. I love the ending of it. And we can maybe talk in generalities for a second.
Oh,
and
sure.
I thought it was so brave how you chose to end it, and so
thanks.
Real, and just not a Hollywood ending. And we don't have to say any more than that. But I wonder, you know, John Irving, the writer, said he starts with the last line of his book. You know, that's how he knows how he's going to start it, how it's going to end. Did you have that ending in your head kind of all along, or did you stumble upon it?
Oh, yeah, thank you. No, I mean, like, the last several pages came out in a few minutes because, you know, I had figured out what the story was and I figured out what the themes were. And so everything was kind of just flowing out at a great kind of rapid pace. And no, the ending just came out naturally and felt like, yeah, kind of, as you mentioned, it's a little unexpected and is not like, yeah, I guess the more traditional ending of a movie. But to me, the movie's not a traditional movie anyway.
No.
It's a movie about, like, you know, these two guys, and you think you have a sense of who they are and that it's a more traditional buddy comedy. And only as the movie unfolds do you realize, actually, these two people are different than what I expected. My character is not just the, you know, neurotic, nervous one. My character is actually stable and completely envious of this guy. And Kieran's character, by contrast, is actually not just this charming, lovable figure, but actually somebody who's quite tragic.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me this. I interviewed a man, you know, Lorcan Finnegan, for a film called Vivarium. And it would have been 4 years ago at this stage. And what I remember about that movie, as much as I enjoyed it, is how incredibly prescient it felt, because it was released here on the 27th of March, and it's about people living in some nameless suburbia stuck in a home. And like, that was right when the lockdown kicked in Ireland, and we were stuck in our homes. I didn't even know who I was going to interview on this show because no one could go to the movies. Have you subsequently been struck by, I know you made it in 2019, but by God, that movie was on the money.
Oh, that's so interesting. My God, yeah, God, I haven't thought about this for 4 years. And yeah, you're right. When we were doing it, it just seemed like this great kind of fever dream about suburbia. But then, of course, became a fever dream about something else, this kind of isolation, this living in a weird sterility, and being paranoid of the outside world and going outside. And you're right, that's what it turned into. Goodness, I forgot how eerie that connection was.
Yeah, well, look, I don't want to bring you back and
freak you out. No, not at all, not at all.
Tell me this, you know, I know people mention The Social Network to you a lot, and it was a fantastic movie, but it's a long time ago and we won't rehash all that. But I'm just wondering, you know, at that time in your life, was it a very head-turning moment when that movie went as far as it did? Like, you'd been in The Squid and Whale and all sorts of things, but I imagine it up a level or two, and you were very recognizable after that. When you look back on it now, you know, it's over 10 years now at this stage. Was it kind of a head turning time in your life?
It was, but, you know, really being in one movie when I was 18 years old was the head turning moment. You know, the difference between basically not being an actor who can get jobs and then being an actor who was in a popular movie. I was in this popular movie when I was 18 called Roger Dodger. When I say popular, it made like $1 million at the box office, but it was just like it was a hit in New York, and filmmakers liked it. So I got jobs after that. And that was the biggest difference. It's literally, you know, it's like when you're writing a script and you have, you know, it's the difference between an empty first page and a filled first page. And, you know, every page after that, some are great, some are not great, some are forgotten, some are not forgotten. But like, for me, just being in that first movie was like totally life-changing. My dad let me defer university and pursue acting. And it was just, you know, that was life-changing. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So that's where the story really begins for you. Well, listen,
yeah,
the story is continuing in fascinating fashion, because A Real Pain is a brilliant, brilliant watch. And I will urge people to go and see it. It's lovely to talk
to you,
Jesse, and continued success.
You're so kind. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Jesse Eisenberg there talking to me about A Real Pain, which is in cinemas from next Wednesday, the 8th of December. A fantastic watch. And just before Christmas, we gave five lucky winners the chance to go and see it in the Lighthouse on Tuesday night, thanks to our friends in Searchlight Pictures. And I know the five of you have been contacted, so let us know how you get on with that. And for those of you who aren't making the premiere, courtesy of this show, you can go and see it from Wednesday. And it is well worth a watch. A real pain in cinemas from the middle of next week. Up next, the Irish breakout star of Black Doves, the great Ella Lily Hyland. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. I'm John Fardy. So, late last year, we spoke about Black Doves, a show on Netflix where Keira Knightley plays a spy who's also married to the British Defence Secretary. It's been going gangbusters on Netflix. It's in the top 10 for weeks now. Very entertaining stuff. We also have Sarah Lancashire in it and Ben Whishaw playing her friend, who's a hitman. But one of the breakout stars, and according to Pat Kenny, when we talked about Black Doves, the best thing in it is Carlow native Ella Lily Hyland. She plays a young, hungry trigger man, or trigger woman. It's kind of a gender neutral phrase, but she's one of the many hitmen and baddies in it. And she's absolutely brilliant in it. She's deadpan, cold, very vicious when it comes to shooting people, but kind of has a pleasant heart as well, if that makes a bit of sense. If you've seen the show, you'll know she is one of the breakout stars. And a lot of people are talking about the fact that she's keeping her Carlow accent in it, and she sounds very Irish and wonderfully so in it. Ella Lily Hyland, as I say, she's a young actress. She was in with Aidan Turner on Prime Video in 2023. 15 Love, that tennis drama. She's one of those people are talking about, you know, as one to watch. It seems to me she's probably already arrived. And as I say, people are adoring her role in Black Doves. So I got a chance to talk to her earlier in the week about her role in Black Dove. And beforehand, here's a little clip of her in the aforementioned Black Doves.
Well, that's a sweet scene.
Really makes the heart melt. Do you want advice? Don't get sentimental.
Do you think that you might be a psychopath, Williams?
Yeah, it's possible, I suppose.
I worry that I might be sometimes.
Psychopaths don't stand outside their ex-boyfriend's flat pining like a slap dog.
I'm going to do Lenny's job so you can go home.
I don't know. We might stay out here for a bit.
Yeah, it's a nice night for it.
Yeah. Best luck with the job, though. I heard last time you and Hector Newman had a run-in, it didn't go so well for you, so just try not to let that play in your mind, I guess.
Ella, have you been surprised by the success of this so far? You know, shows come out a lot on all the streamers, Netflix included, but this has gone straight to the top and it's having a life that maybe you weren't expecting, but you tell me.
Yeah, no, totally. I wasn't expecting it at all. I feel like you never really know what to expect. But it's great to feel like having such a response. I just know, like, when I read it, I just thought it was so clever and so brilliantly written and nuanced and unique. So it's lovely to feel that people are enjoying it, you know, and I think it's such a great time of year for people to be watching telly as well, so it's just great. It's great when good stuff is on the telly, though, isn't it? Like, you're just like, it's brilliant, like, to you know.
You said telly like a proper Irish person as well, which is wonderful. I'm glad to see the bright lights of London haven't got you saying TV all the time, you know. Tell me this, your character, right? You said you read it and she thought she was great. She's very unusual in terms of, because she's a badass of the highest order and knows her way around a bazooka. She's very sharp. She's very critical. She's also hilariously humorous. But she also might, in a weird kind of way, despite being a trigger man or trigger woman or trigger person, have a heart of gold on some level. Or how do you see her?
Yeah, I agree. I think she's like definitely has such like deep loyalty, do you know what I mean? And which is beautiful and it makes her kind of complicated, but also like really human, you know. And I think that is something that she craves is connection and friendship from Eleanor and even from like Sam and Helen, like, you know what I mean? She if she says she's going to be involved, she's involved, and she'll do what she says she's going to do, you know, which is something I really like about her. And yeah, I agree. I think she does have a heart of gold.
Yeah. Now, listen, lots of people, you've probably been asked this all morning, so forgive me, but people are very pleased with the fact that you're keeping your accent, the Carlow accent, the Midland accent. And it's funny that people are making, in a way, such a big deal out of it. But in your head, was it always, this is what I'm going to do? Or did you make a conscious decision to keep your accent?
Yeah, like, I think, like, the accent is, like, you know, my accent is different in a way, like, oh, I think, like, it has a lot of similarities, but I think it's like when I read it with like the energy of that Midlands tone. I think it's something that kind of accidentally happened because Joe wrote it definitely in an Irish like colloquialism.
Yeah.
But she kind of could have been anything when I first read the script. You know, she could have been anything. But it just all kind of tied together in that way. Like, I saw her that way, and it worked with the language, I think. So, but it was great to get to use that voice, because I do feel strongly that Midlands tone isn't seen a lot. Like, even in our work, you know, like, I think it's kind of a really specific voice and accent, and it felt really, you know, empowering or something to get to share it in that kind of a show, you know.
Hear, hear. Tell me this. I read something very interesting about you, that for 15 Love, you lied about how much tennis you could and couldn't play. Is that accurate, or is that the internet tricking us?
Yeah. No. My agent did, because I went for I'm really close with the writer of 15 Love, Hania, and she took me for dinner when we were filming. She was like, so what made you choose between like acting and tennis? And I was like, what? I said, I didn't. So my agent has said that it was between acting and tennis. And she was like, yeah, someone told me that you had to choose between acting and tennis. I was like, I never had a tennis racket in my hand in my life. In this show. So he was obviously really wanted me to get in the room and said that.
Yeah, well, that's what a good agent does, I guess, you know. We do a favourite slot on this show where we talk to well-known people, not just actors. We've done former presidents and things about their favourite film. And I saw another thing about you, and I'm not sure if it's necessarily your favourite film, but Song for a Raggy Boy, you said kind of woke something in you, or just maybe there's a before and after moment seeing that film with the great Aidan Quinn. Well, what is it that struck you about that film, or for you? I know why it's a great movie and all, but what was it that awoke you?
I think I begged to watch it for so long, and I obviously, as a kid, I didn't know, like, I knew like some things about like the church, but like it was all alluded to, because you don't, I guess, learn about that kind of thing until it's appropriate to learn about it. But like I watched it when I was really young, and I just remember being like really upset and really angry, and I think like weirdly like a lot of like work that I've done as an adult acting wise like that has been in a period where the church has been oppressive or like anything like that. Like, I felt really strongly about it, and it feels like, I don't know, like, I guess it's such an integral part of who we are as people that's a part of our history, you know what I mean? And the oppression and the bullying that went on. Like, I actually watched Small Things Like These last night for the first time.
Yeah.
And like, just that, like, I thought that was so beautiful. But it's such a huge part of who we are, you know, and it's like in our DNA as Irish people and as storytellers. So I think like I don't know, I guess, how it affected me at the time, because I was a kid and I probably was too young to watch it. But I think, I guess, like our heritage and who we are and all of that feels really important as an artist, or if you have a voice in anywhere, you're expressing something, because it feels like in an oppressed state or anything that's been kind of bullied or controlled in that way, that speaking out and expression in terms of any type of storytelling or artistry is a form of rebellion. Do you know what I mean? And that anger that we feel, or that we feel in response to that, or as storytellers, is actually fuel for I guess creativity. I don't know. I'm going on now, but I think
no.
Yeah, I do think it's such an important part of our history, and part of our DNA, you know.
Yeah, well, it was clearly an important movie for you. Tell me this, can I be so bold as to ask, what's next then? You're having this moment with Black Dove, so where do you go from here? Or can you say?
I don't know. Like, I guess I don't know if I'm allowed to say everything I'm doing next year, but I'm writing at the minute, which is fun. So okay. That's what I'm doing, yeah. And yeah, just see how that goes.
Okay, telling us nothing, but that's fine. We hear that a lot. Well, listen, you were great in Black Doves, and whatever the future holds, when you can or can't talk about it, we look forward to seeing you in that. Lovely to meet you, Ella.
Lovely to meet you, John. Thanks, Emil.
Ella Lily Hyland there, talking about what the future may and may not hold, her role in 15 Love, and of course her role in Black Doves, now on Netflix, where she is being rightly lauded for her role in that, opposite people like Keira Knightley and Ben Whishaw. And if you haven't checked out Black Doves, why not check it out? Because it's a very entertaining watch, a bit daft, but brilliantly entertaining, you know, where Keira Knightley is a spy who's also married to the British Defence Secretary and has been married to him as part of her kind of ruse and her deceptive lifestyle. Very entertaining. Now, that's all very new. So what about a little old Hollywood glamour to finish tonight? Later this month, we'll see the anniversary of the passing of the one and only Audrey Hepburn, one of the most iconic actresses of all time. So I thought, to warm the cockles on this cold winter evening, why not have a little listen to a profile I did a few years ago in this station of the great Audrey Hepburn.
Style someday. Audrey
Hepburn was a style icon, a ballerina, part of the resistance movement against National Socialism, a UNICEF ambassador, and of course she was an actress. She was quite simply a Hollywood legend.
Now I've got a wonderful idea. We could spend the whole day doing things we've never done before. We'll take turns. For something you've never done, and me. Because I can't really think of anything I've never done.
Hepburn was born in Belgium in 1929, and she loved to dance and wanted to be a ballerina, and had no real interest in acting all her young life. Her father left the family home at an early age, and it was an ache that stayed with her all her life. Here's her biographer, Barry Paris.
Her father left the family, abandoned them completely. This was one of the worst events of her life and one of the most defining moments of her life in a very negative way. It always left her with an insecurity, which she herself spoke of frequently.
At an early age, her mother sent her to a boarding school in England in a bid to make her more outgoing. But the experiment ended abruptly when the Nazi threat started to spread across Europe. And her Dutch mother decided that the best thing would be to move the family to Holland, country which intended to stay neutral. But the stormtroopers came into the Netherlands. Hepburn, like millions of others, nearly starved when the Nazis cut off food supplies. But Hepburn was no idle victim, and during the war delivered messages for the resistance movement and also put on ballerina performances that would help the resistance movement. She recalled this much later in one of her screen tests.
Didn't know how long the war was going to last, so I went to a ballet school and learned to dance. And in about 1944, about a year before the end of the war, I was quite capable of performing. And it was a sort of some way in which I could make some contribution. And I did give performances to collect money for the underground, which always needed money.
And what about the Germans? What did they do about it?
They didn't know about it.
Having survived the war, Hepburn went to study dance and became a chorus girl on the London stage. She played small walk-on parts in British Ealing comedies, but her moment arrived when she was just 22. It seemed that her natural beauty and charm were destined to make her special, and she was cast on the Broadway stage in the theatrical version of Gigi. Here, film and fashion historian Pamela Church explains.
She was making a film in Monte Carlo, and Colette, the novelist who, of course, wrote Gigi, was being pushed across a hotel lobby. She was very old by this time, and she saw this very pretty young girl, who was off duty, sort of kidding about with, you know, a group of people near a piano, and she saw instantly that this was the embodiment of Gigi, and she famously said, "I found my Gigi."
Only 2 years after that, Hepburn won her first Oscar for her part in Roman Holiday opposite Gregory Peck. She was perfectly cast as the royal princess who briefly escapes her regal duties, and audiences went wild for her.
Why don't you take a little time for yourself?
Maybe another hour.
Live dangerously. Take the whole day.
I could do some of the things I've always wanted to.
Like what?
Oh, you can't imagine. I'd like to do just whatever I like the whole day long.
Things like having your hair cut, eating gelato.
Yes, and I'd like to sit a sidewalk cafe and look in shop windows, walk in the rain, have fun, and maybe some excitement. Doesn't seem much to you, does it?
It's great.
Soon after Roman Holiday, she was back on stage in Ondine, playing a water nymph who falls in love with a human.
Ondine is a very beautiful love story in which Mel Ferrer and I appear together. Mel plays the knight errant and I play a water sprite.
She would marry Ferrer, her co-star, the following year. She continued to wow Hollywood in roles like Sabrina, the young woman in the Billy Wilder comedy of the same name, where she played a Cinderella-style young beauty recently returned from Paris.
David, I don't believe I know this young lady.
Oh, yes, you do.
Good evening, Mrs. Larrabee.
Mother, this is Miss Fairchild.
Sabrina?
Yes, of course. You didn't recognize me, did you? Have I changed? Have I really changed?
You certainly have.
Her next movie projects were more serious affairs, acting in a version of Tolstoy's War and Peace, and she earned another Oscar nomination for her role in A Nun Story, which saw her gain rave reviews for her portrayal of a woman struggling to live a religious life.
A nun is a disciplined person.
Yes, but not necessarily tense. As a surgeon, it's not my business to pry into the mind, but I'd say that tension is the sign of an exhausting inner struggle.
Do you realize that every time you make me talk to you like this, I should go down on my knees before my sisters and proclaim my fault?
Away from movies, Hepburn had her own struggles, finding it difficult to conceive a child. She suffered several miscarriages and fell into deep depression over it. But in 1960, her son Sean was born. Her role as a mother was by far the most important role of her life. And here her son, Sean Ferreira, explains.
She very much wanted to have children. She loved children. I think it may have been a way to heal her own youth. But I think she wanted that friendship, which she got. We were great friends.
But despite how much she enjoyed being a mother, she wasn't finished acting. And her next role was, well, iconic is an overused term these days, but in this case it rings very true.
Won't you join me?
Yes, join Audrey Hepburn as you've never seen her before, kicking over the traces and bringing to life Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Hepburn played Holly-Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and it's a role that defined her. Wearing that iconic black dress, she plays the jolly but slightly troubled good time girl who has romantic friction with a struggling writer played by George Peppard.
You know those days when you get the mean reds?
The mean reds? You mean like the blues?
No. The blues are because you're getting fat or maybe it's been raining too long. You're just sad, that's all. The mean reds are horrible. Suddenly you're afraid and you don't know what you're afraid of. Did you ever get that feeling?
Sure.
But when I get it, the only thing that does any good is to jump into a cab and go to Tiffany's. Calms me down right away. The quietness and the proud look of it, nothing very bad could happen to you there. If I could find a real life place that made me feel like Tiffany's, then
I'd buy some furniture and give the cat a name.
Hepburn, by this stage, was one of the world's most famous movie stars, and she worked all through the 60s, and even played the lead in a musical, My Fair Lady, as the flower girl turned high society woman.
I want to be a lady in a flower shop, instead of sitting at the corner of Tottenham Court Road. But they won't take me unless I can talk more genteel. He said he could teach me. Well, here I am, ready to pay him, not asking any favour, and he treats me as if I was dirt.
But the Hollywood chiefs weren't too happy with her singing, and bizarrely, they used a singing double for her lines. Here's a surviving piece of Hepburn's original singing, and you'd have to wonder what the problem was.
There'll be spring every year without you. England still will be here without you. There'll be fruit on the tree and a shore by the sea. There'll be crumpets and tea without you. Art and music will thrive without you. Somehow Keats will survive without you. And there still will be rain on that plain down in Spain. Even that will remain.
By the early 70s, Hepburn was divorced and remarried to an Italian psychiatrist and had had a second son. Living in rural Switzerland, she worked only sporadically in the 70s and 80s. But in her very last years, she had something of a third act, where she became a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF. This was no shallow celebrity goodwill gesture. She was constantly travelling to famine-ravished parts of the globe, and it became almost a full-time job. Her own hungry childhood and World War II stayed with her all her life. Her last on-screen role was in Steven Spielberg's Always, where she played an angel. Richard Dreyfuss, her co-star, explains why the role really suited her.
I remember that Steven was trying to figure out who could be God or the angel of heaven. Who could ever pull that off? He said, Audrey Hepburn. And everyone went, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Towards the end of her life, she experienced one of those strange full circle moments. During the Nazi occupation of her hometown in Holland, she'd been forced to eat tulip bulbs to avoid starvation. In 1990, she had a new hybrid of tulip named after her. So it seems that literally the flower of Audrey Hepburn lives on screen, but also on quiet hills in Holland.
All dream maker, you heart breaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. To drifters off to see the world.
Ah, yes, Moon River there. From Breakfast at Tiffany's, sung by the wonderful Audrey Hepburn. That was a little look back at her life and times. I thought I would warm you up on this cold January with something a little old Hollywood for you there. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I will be talking to the one and only Angelina Jolie about her new biopic of sorts, all about Maria Callas. So all that to come next week on Screen Time. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Let me wish you a happy new year once again. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.